Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, humidity 73%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. A lot has been written about Donald Trump, our 45th president, but not every story has yet been told. That is, the story of Donald Trump has not yet been completely told. Maybe it'll never be told. But one very important facet of the Donald Trump story is explored in a really fascinating new book called The Method to the Madness, Donald Trump's Ascent as Told by Those Who Were Hired, Fired, Inspired, and Inaugurated. This is a book which examines, in a sense, the build-up to Donald Trump's ultimate decision to, in fact, run for president and, of course, being elected president, and what perhaps was behind his decision, some of the initial efforts that he made as he at least reflected on the possibility with increasing seriousness, and some of what he did in those years before he ultimately ran for president that served as a very valuable preparation that helped us see the kind of campaign that he would run and also showed us the kind of president that he would ultimately be. It's a very, very interesting book co-written by Aaron Short and my morning show guest, Alan Salkin, who has actually covered Donald Trump for many, many years as a reporter for both the New York Post and the New York Times. You may know him from a very interesting history of the Food Network, and he is a very talented writer in many, many different respects. This book is published by All Points Books. Again, it's titled The Method to the Madness, Donald Trump's Ascent as Told by Those Who Were Hired, Fired, Inspired, and Inaugurated. Alan Salkin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, happy to be here, Greg. Thank you.
I wonder if you could just expand on what I tried to convey in the introduction. I'm not sure how good a job I did, but this idea that you are writing about one of the most famous men, maybe the most famous man on the planet, about whom so much has been written, and a lot has been written about much of what is covered in this book, but maybe it's covered or explored in a different way, with a different sort of focus. Explain the new nature of this book, or the sort of the new sort of story it tells.
People think that, a lot of people still think that Donald Trump decided on a whim sometime in 2014 or something that to become president, and he woke up, he rode down his escalator, made a funny speech, you know, and then said crazy things in the debates just to get attention, and then whoops, he won. And he has this look of surprise on election night, and people think, oh, he was thinking to himself, uh-oh, what do I do now? The truth is that Donald Trump has, during the 15-year period that we cover in our book, and certainly going back, you sound like you may be old enough to remember Rona Barrett, the great entertainment reporter. He gave an interview to Rona in 1982 in which he talks about thinking about becoming president, but not sure if a guy with his predilections and background and looks and weird hair, which was unlike Reagan's great hair, could ever be elected president. So he has been strategizing seriously since at least 1999 when he made this exploration of a bid on the Reform Party ticket, which was the party from Ross Perot, about how he could, a guy like him could win a race for president. And one other thing, our book has 114 named on the record sources. On the cover, it says no anonymous sources. That is very different from the other books that are out there.
Absolutely. And they are a fascinating array, including people who worked with Donald Trump, people who covered him, people who maybe knew him a little more from afar, all the way from famous journalists to people who served as his bartender, that kind of thing. It's a really interesting array of voices that we hear. And I want to say a quick word about the format of the book. I wish there was a maybe there is a term for this kind of book, which I like to call first-person script, in which we are hearing from these various people, not couched within your words, but just their words given to us as though we're reading a script, and their name followed by a colon, and then exactly their words, what they have to say about Donald Trump and that particular topic being covered. We see these kind of books. It's a format I really like. Why did you choose it?
Well, I was a big fan of the ESPN and the Saturday Night Live oral histories, which is sort of one term people use. And I had done a book on the Food Network and was kind of felt bad that I had all these great interviews and so much of which I couldn't use. So when Aaron came to me with sort of a general idea that this was a book we might be able to do, I said, well, I handed him the Saturday Night Live oral history, and I said, this is the format I'd like to do this in, because I know there are so many people who I know in the media who have great Trump stories that aren't being chronicled, that we could really do something here that's unique and tell. And also, it just reads so beautifully quickly in this format. There's just something delicious about it. And I'll just throw in there the audiobook, which people don't, you know, authors don't often talk about the audiobook version, but it's really arranged like a radio play, like what you're talking about. And we have actors, we even have a Trump impersonator. So it actually makes a great listen.
It's interesting that Rona Barrett interview that you just mentioned, that is from the early 1980s, and it's one of the first occasions on which he touches on the possibility of perhaps someday running for president. I mean, she asks him if that's something he might want to do. And in his answer, he says he probably wouldn't, because I think it's a very mean life.
Yeah.
I find that a fascinating response. Do you find that fascinating and kind of surprising?
I've thought about that exact line many times. And, you know, Rona told me that she did not go into that interview intending to ask him about this. It was just that he started talking about the Iran hostages, and she said, this guy is into politics. And so I think that there is part of Trump. He's a, you know, obviously he's one of the great media figures. He knows how to create conflict, which is always good in an article and a story, and it's great for television. But I think there is part of him that likes fighting in the business world, but maybe at least at that point wasn't quite ready to, I don't know. You know, honestly, Greg, I don't know. I've thought about that too. Why would he say that? Well, he's a guy who seems to spoil for a fight and loves fights, by the way, loves fighters, loves boxing and worldwide wrestling. It is an odd, maybe it was just a, you know, a momentary lapse. Maybe Ivana, who he was then married to, was standing right off to the side during that interview, Rona said, and he just looked at her and he thought, I don't know. I don't know if I want to drag her into this.
The first chapter of the book is titled Tipster. And I always find this intriguing when we see the title of a chapter and we have no idea why chapter one of this book is called that. What is a tipster and how was Donald Trump a tipster? And then we read into this and we find out exactly what you mean by that term of tipster. This would be right before Donald Trump begins to signal some interest in running for president someday, when he seems, as much as anything, bent on elevating his persona before the American public. Explain what was so important to Donald Trump at this point in time and how good he was at elevating his public profile in this way.
Well, this is the period when I first come into contact with him, because I was working at the New York Post in that era, you know, which is a serious but noisy kind of tabloid New York newspaper. And we all had Trump's number on speed dial. You knew that you could call him and get a quote about just about anything, you know, within 5 minutes, you could get him on the line. And for years, you know, as a guy who was not just a reporter but an author, I learned from Donald Trump, be available to journalists if you want to end up in the newspaper, because they'll call somebody else if you don't get on the phone immediately. So he was now, at this point, when we pick him up, single. He finished his second marriage, divorced from Marla Maples, and he was basically out on the scene at night in New York, chasing models and trying to rebuild after a lot of business setbacks. So he would gather gossip from his nights out, and he would, in the morning, call the gossip reporters at the New York Daily News, Newsday, whoever he could get, and talk to them about what he knew, who was sleeping with who he saw, you know, at the bar. And in exchange, when he wanted his name put into the gossip pages, he insisted that he be called a billionaire. And these were not the kind of reporters who were going to go comb through all of his business records. Now, I actually did, because I wasn't a gossip reporter. And I wrote a big article about, well, what does Trump actually own? What does he not? But these guys didn't care. They just loved he was giving him stuff. And he didn't care if they called him a pompous billionaire, an obnoxious billionaire, a skirt-chasing billionaire. As long as it was billionaire, that was going to help his business. And moving forward also, that kind of training for little great tidbits that would get attention that starts in that great training ground of New York newspapers applies beautifully to the Twitter era, where little catchy nuggets are what is the currency of the realm.
Hmm. You quote Lloyd Grove, a gossip reporter for the New York Daily News, saying that Donald Trump had a natural ability to communicate in bold headlines. I mean, whether he's passing on gossip or issuing a tweet on some a hot button topic, that has for a long time been something he's really, really good at. I want to ask you about a very interesting observation made in this chapter by none other than Katie Couric, of course, former host of the Today Show on NBC. She says at one point in this chapter, if the city is a play, then he's a character in that city, a Damon Runyon type guy. He was never really embraced by New York society or the big swinging you-know-whats of Wall Street. He never had the street cred that he was searching for or got the imprimatur of someone of some of those more sophisticated social people, and it drove him crazy. I think this observation might really come as a surprise to people who might think that all wealthy people show up at the same parties and all know each other and like each other. Katie Couric's painting a very different picture of Donald Trump and, in a sense, his place in the cultural landscape of New York City.
Donald comes from Queens, not from Manhattan. His dad made a ton of money, but building apartment complexes for middle-income people throughout the other boroughs, the other parts of New York City. And, you know, Donald, like I said, is a big fan of wrestling, and I think about this a lot. The suit, the red tie, the hair, this is his version of Jesse Ventura or Hulk Hogan's ripped T-shirt. This is his caricature. This is his uniform that people think, oh, he's a big mucky muck. But it's a character. And he's become that character, no question. And he does, you know, at his restaurants, hobnob with, you know, he helped Katie Couric with her kid's birthday party by keeping a skating rink open for her extra long. But he considers himself an outsider to all the, you know, established blue bloods in New York City. And I do think that there is a part of him that understands that part of America that feels left out and not part of the big party. And those eventually become, you know, what Steve Bannon calls the deplorables and the real deep Trump supporters.
In the second chapter called The Tough and Tireless, we hear for the first time from Republican strategist Roger Stone. And you call him one of three sort of political fathers that Donald Trump had, his own father, attorney Roy Cohn, and then Roger Stone. And we hear a lot from Roger Stone and then from other people who knew Roger Stone very, very well. And a lot of them give Roger Stone a lot of credit for being, in a sense, the architect of Donald Trump's political aspirations. I want to ask you about an observation of Roger Stone himself when he said he, meaning Donald Trump, had a low regard for politicians, a low regard for the political system, a low regard for all the supplicants who came sniveling for money. He disdained the system, even though he was participating in it by giving. Can you help us make sense of that?
It's a guy like Trump who had, you know, a lot of money, most of it from his father, but some earned. These guys, these politicians would come to Trump Tower. He would make them wait in the waiting room, you know, like just to show who was in charge for half an hour, like the head of the Republican National Committee. They'd come in and beg him for, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. And he gave to – he was a Republican. That's what Roger Stone says for his whole life. Trump was and his father was. But he gave to Democrats and independents also, Joe Lieberman, Robert Torricelli, Ed Renzel, because these people were politicians in areas where Trump had casinos, and he wanted to have influence to make sure that he got approved, his projects got approved, that the casino board approved him. So he was able to buy influence for what for him would be lunch for him and a few staff members. So how could you ultimately have respect for these people who were fighting over such small potatoes and who thought they were his friend, even though he did not agree with them politically, thought he was their friend because he was throwing a few shekels their way?
In a sense, he found that to be sort of a pathetic way to live, and yet he was willingly becoming a part of that world. In the third chapter of the book, the title is Ross for Boss, and we are talking here about the late Ross Perot, and we just happened to be recording this interview a day or two after Mr. Perot's death. You write in your introduction to this chapter, in many ways, Perot was Trump before Trump. Explain what you see as the most intriguing parallels between these two men, Ross Perot and Donald Trump.
Well, first of all, Trump's first, and may he rest in peace, he was a great American character and a very interesting politician who may very well have won if he hadn't done some crazy things in 92 in the election. But because Perot did so well in 92 and 96, his party, the Reform Party, ended up with about $12 million in federal matching funds to give to whoever the candidate would be in 2000. And Trump was very interested in that money, and Roger Stone pushed him to see if he could get traction and see if it was possible to win. That money ended up going to Pat Buchanan, who basically, because of screwed up ballots in Florida, you know, that tosses the election to George W. Bush. But Perot would talk about – Perot was into he was against the North American Free Trade Agreement, just like Trump. He was against foreign wars, really just like Trump. Trump hated both Gulf Wars and really is not interested in spending American money on foreign fights like that. But especially as regards NAFTA, Perot would talk about, you know, the giant sucking sound of American jobs going to Mexico if NAFTA was passed. And Perot's sucking sound is Donald Trump's border wall. It is a sense of America is being depleted, and we need to protect ourselves, and also to signal to those who don't want so much immigration that this is their guy. And there was an appeal to people who felt left out, and that there was a no-nonsense businessman could capture their attention. Trump took a lot from Perot. He also took from Buchanan, who was more explicitly anti-immigrant. So over the years, you know, all of these people, including Jesse Ventura at the time, who won as a Reform Party candidate in Minnesota, the former wrestler, influenced Trump, and he starts to see how somebody who's from outside the system can get traction.
We're speaking with Alan Salkin, who is the co-author with Aaron Short of a book called The Method to the Madness, Donald Trump's Ascent, as told by those who were hired, fired, inspired, and inaugurated. I know that many people will especially enjoy the second portion of the book, which is called Playing the Part, in which you explore primarily Donald Trump's experience with the television show The Apprentice. And I learned so much from this chapter because, honestly, that's a television show I don't ever remember watching, not one single episode. It was just of no interest to me. But it turns out that all of us who are interested in who Donald Trump is and the forces that have shaped him should know something about The Apprentice, because you contend that this was extremely important, not only in elevating his profile, but also in teaching him some lessons and helping shape the kind of presidential candidate and president he would ultimately become. What is most important for us to know about these years with The Apprentice?
Well, he learns how television works even better than before. He learns about teasers, you know. Tune in tomorrow and I'll tell you who my Secretary of State's going to be, you know. Well, I'll tell you in 5 more minutes when you come back from the commercial break. He learns that. He also learns, and this is something I've thought about, the reality of a reality show is not reality. It is storytelling. There's all kinds, and we chronicle the ways that The Apprentice was not real in who he chose to hire, which it looks like he chose the first season's winner based on race, not on who was the most qualified. There were all kinds of breaking of game show rules behind the scenes, but what is happening behind the scenes doesn't matter, because what gets edited and what goes out in that 43 minutes of television between commercials is what matters. And you just keep going forward. The show goes on. And also, and probably most importantly, those of us in New York who lived in New York knew a lot about Trump, his failures and his achievements. Most of the country did not know much about him. He was just a sort of real estate guy who had an airplane. On The Apprentice, America learns about this decisive guy in this beautiful office, which was all a set. Those were not his real offices, who is the arbiter of everything. And he's in control, and what he says goes, and he makes decisions. And it presents, again, a character who looks like he's in total control of everything. So that image of Trump is something that he starts to, and he always did understand that, but he sees even more now, celebrity can be levered upon into political power. And the better his ratings, the more people knew his name, the more likely he would be able to have success in politics.
Among the really interesting things we learn in these chapters that deal with these years with The Apprentice, it's especially intriguing to read the chapter called Below the Belt, in which we learn of some of the really nasty spats that Donald Trump had with a number of different people, chiefly Rosie O'Donnell. I think one of the most, and you speak with her, she's one of the voices of your book. One of the people we hear from as you are talking about this is actually Randall Pinkett, who was the winner of the fourth season of The Apprentice. And he says, "I've been in the room with Donald Trump alone, and I've been in closed-door meetings with Donald, and there's something inside of Donald that is insecure about whether he's the richest, the smartest, the baddest person in the room. There's an overcompensation to prove that to others, like the kid in the sandbox who couldn't get along with everybody, and now he's all grown up. Do you hear truth in that observation?
Randall is a great guy and very, very intelligent, and I think almost all of his observations really have truth to them. And I do think that, you know, I like doing these interviews. I like reading every review of my book. I like reading all the comments about my book, even the negative ones on Amazon, all my books. And I understand this. There's something about, you know, and especially if you're trying to build a character like Donald was, there's something about seeing yourself through the world's eyes that there's something reinforcing about it. And there's also something weak about it. I'm not saying this is good behavior. I do think that clearly he feeds on it. He feeds on the attention. He sees that what, and maybe it's just this, he sees that what he's doing, the game he's playing, is working. He has a strategy, which is what our book, The Method to the Madness, right? He has a strategy about how he wants to play the world. When I interviewed him I ghostwrote basically a column for him for the New York Post around the millennium, and he talked about that New York is just one big, you know, game, and it's a game played at a very high level, and it's kind of played in restaurants when you walk in and the attitude that you have. And I just think he likes seeing, you know, how he's doing at the table. He likes to count his chips.
Your book does explore the matter of the birther controversy. And one of the things that I found surprising was all of the people around Donald Trump, advising Donald Trump, who strenuously objected to that, and particularly when he held on to that for dear life. And that was really striking. Was that surprising to you, that there were so many advisors to Donald Trump who really did not think that that was a good idea and or worthy of him?
You know, he moves through advisors. You know, some hang on for a few years and longer, like Stone, and others, you know, only last a few months, and just like in the White House. And ultimately, and this is, you know, the central part of our book, Trump has an idea of what he's doing, and other people around him don't understand the game he's playing, and it doesn't matter to him. He needs them for certain reasons, and he understood that. Look, most people looked at the situation and understood this is racist, and that this is probably very, very, very likely not true. Obama was born in Hawaii to an American mother, right? So, but that wasn't what was right, and what was reasonable was not what Trump was doing. He was, at that point, clearly had identified a constituency that wanted this kind of thing, wanted these kinds of attacks, felt there was something wrong about Obama. He didn't, you know, and probably what they felt was wrong was that they didn't like an African-American being president. But he sensed that. And he knew that by taking this stance, he could get followers and get attention. And he was, and he also, as we say in the book, he knows that celebrity, he says this, we quote him, celebrity fighting celebrity gets attention. And that's what he was doing. So reasonable people around him said this isn't reasonable. But that, to him, it was reasonable because it got him what he wanted.
You tell us in the chapter called Roasted that as that controversy was still raging, this is now 2012, there was an occasion not long after President Obama finally produced his birth certificate that Donald Trump attended the White House Correspondents Association dinner as a guest of a Washington Post reporter, and President Obama scored some very pointed jokes at Donald Trump's expense, to Donald Trump's visible displeasure. And you tell us that the simplistic narrative is that Donald Trump was so angered, so humiliated, that that's when he decided once and for all that he would indeed run for president. You think that that's wrong, and you want us to understand that moment very, very differently. How do you think we should look at that moment and how it was important for Donald Trump?
Trump was sitting there, and people think he's not smiling because he's when Obama's roasting him, because he doesn't like that the president, you know, that he's being humiliated. That is not what it was. What Trump was doing was thinking, and this is, you know, based on what a lot of people told us, what Trump was doing was thinking to himself, it's working. I'm annoying the president. You know, that is, and he was just, his wheels were turning. This thing I'm doing is working. And I often compare Trump to a boxer. I'm starting to write an article about this. And boxers in the early rounds of a fight, what are they supposed to do? They hit them, they work the opponent to the body. You hit him in the stomach. And eventually people lose their will. And then you can knock him out by hitting him in the head. And I think Trump was just peppering, you know, he'd been peppering Obama with these little body hits. And he saw that it was having an effect. You know, Obama was starting to, as like a boxer would, he was starting to breathe through his mouth instead of his nose. Trump, look, our book shows that Trump was seriously thinking about running for president starting as early as 99 and before that. So it simply, and our book, as you know, as you've said, has all these not, has 114 on the record sources. If you read it, I don't know how you, and I'm just saying, I don't know how you come away with any other understanding that he was plotting to become president for many years. So the idea that he sits there at a dinner once and goes, well, I'm going to beat him. It's just, it's like, it's reality TV. It's not real.
Right. The story is much richer and much more complex than that. And by the way, you I think, have a very good observation as well, that President Obama, of course, was joking about all kinds of different people. But Donald Trump received roughly 7 times more words than any of the other high-level Republicans. You write, like in the Republican debates on the 2016 campaign trail, Trump's outrageousness earned him that most valuable asset, camera time.
Yeah, that's it. You know, this is, he understood a game better than others. And what you see now, and you can see it playing out in the Democratic debates, they have studied Trump. And anybody who wants to beat Trump should read our book. Our book is not about whether Trump is a, you know, whether you like him or you don't like him and his policies. It's about, this is how he did it. This is his method. And if you, you know, want to beat him, you might take something from him that he figured out. There is a genius to Trump. And you can see the Democrats all fighting for every word to get in there because they know, you know, decorum is not what matters. What matters is say more words, more camera time. Unless, of course, you're Marianne Williamson, who somehow managed to get a lot of attention with very few words.
I want to mention quickly that your book includes a lot of conversation about the various books that he has written and much of what he has written in those books, including a lot of things that are in stark contrast or contradiction to now the positions that he is taking as president. I mean, that just further, in a sense, enriches our understanding of how just how complicated a man Donald Trump is, and the rich story of how he considered running for the presidency for many, many years, and of course, when he finally did so, was successful. The book is The Method to the Madness, Donald Trump's Ascent as Told by Those Who Were Hired, Fired, Inspired, and Inaugurated, published by All Points Books. Alan Salkin, one of its authors. Alan Salkin, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book.
Oh, it's great to be here, Greg. It's a great conversation, and I really appreciate your understanding and thorough reading of the book.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be looking back at the dramatic moment in American history when the Star-Spangled Banner was penned by Francis Scott Key. My guest is Steve Vogel, a reporter with the Washington Post and the author of a fascinating book that was published in 2014 in the 200th anniversary year of the Star-Spangled Banner. The book is called Through the Perilous Fight, From the Burning of Washington to the Star-Spangled Banner, The 6 Weeks That Saved a Nation, published by Random House. Steve Vogel, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
I'm glad to be here.
I am so glad that this book has been written, in part because I think many Americans, and I count myself among them, know very little about the War of 1812. Can you tell us, in general, what is the what are the circumstances which set that war in motion, and why that war was fought in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. It's often been forgotten what the causes of that war were. But it's important to remember, first of all, that the United States declared war on Great Britain and not the other way around. You know, sometimes people assume that Great Britain was trying to retake the colonies. And really, this war should be seen as an offshoot of the much larger conflict that was going on in Europe. The Great War between Great Britain and France that had been raging for about 20 years. And with the rise of Napoleon in France, Great Britain was fighting what it saw as a war for survival, not only for itself, but really for civilization. And Napoleon was in command of much of continental Europe by 1812. So in pursuing their war aims, Great Britain did not hesitate to trample on American sovereignty to make sure that they had the sailors they needed for sailing their ships. For example, they stopped American ships at sea, and anybody they suspected of being of British origin, they would take off and put to work on the Royal Navy. They would impress them, and you know, essentially it was a form of kidnapping. And Great Britain was also blocking American trade with the continent. So President Madison, by 1812, had come to the conclusion that if the United States were to allow this to continue, we might as well not have won our independence a generation earlier, that you know, we were really just a vassal state. And so in June of 1812, by a very narrow margin, Congress declared war, and the nation was very divided on this issue.
So one of the iconic moments, of course, from the War of 1812 is the burning of Washington. And your book is a valuable way for us to understand, maybe better than we otherwise would, just the level of national trauma which that represented. Just tell our listeners a bit more about, in a sense, symbolically, and also in fact, in point of fact, what the burning of Washington represented at that point in our young nation's history.
Well, this was a very dangerous and very low moment in United States history, and we sometimes today forget just how precarious it was and how close the nation was to collapse. But, you know, the British, after waging this war without full strength for the first 2 years, after Napoleon's abdication in April of 1814, they send more force over to the United States to try to put an end to this war and really make sure the United States would never again be in a position to declare a war like this. They were hoping to really, if not collapse the country, leave us in a very weakened state. And so the capture of Washington was a very bold operation by that was dreamed up by Admiral George Coburn. And once the army troops arrive under the command of General Ross, he is persuaded to give this a try. The idea for the British was really to force the United States to so humiliate the government, to force them to make peace on British terms, and perhaps force the collapse of the American government. And after defeating militia forces that were set up outside Washington at Blaydensburg 200 years ago on August 24th, 1814, the British had an open path to the city, and they moved in and began burning that night the Capitol, the White House, really every federal building save one was destroyed. The Washington Navy Yard was put up into flames by the Americans themselves to keep it from falling into British hands. President Madison and his government are forced to flee. You know, there's no Air Force One to whisk him away. This was a very a precarious moment in American history. And the events that follow in Baltimore 3 weeks later are going to be so critical to turning it around.
One of the points of studying or challenges of studying something like this, that is the burning of Washington and also the circumstances under which Francis Scott Key saw that flag bravely flying the morning after that bombardment on Baltimore and Fort McHenry. So much legend, so much myth has sprung up. In fact, just ahead of a patriotic recital, which I just sang where I teach in honor of this anniversary, I was sent by a couple of different people links to various little video montages about the Star-Spangled Banner, and I could just tell from watching them that they were just soggy with myth about what in fact had occurred. And I should think for you as a historian trying to write a serious treatment of these events, it must be a tricky challenge to make your way through all of that and figure out what in fact happened.
You're right. I mean, there are a lot of myths surrounding this story, you know, and the thing is, the real story doesn't need embellishment. I mean, the what actually happened is certainly dramatic enough, and in many cases is a lot more interesting than some of these myths. You know, some of the myths have a little bit of root in truth, but, you know, going through the records as I did, and the letters and documents, both of the British and the Americans involved, and Francis Scott Key himself, I think I was able to put together a very specific chronological account that details the burning of Washington and the mission that Francis Scott Key launches to rescue an American doctor who is held prisoner by the British, and then the chain of circumstances that leave him in this unique position to watch the bombardment and attack of Baltimore.
Mm. I think one of the trickiest matters is to understand the kind of real peril that Fort McHenry faced in this bombardment versus what it appeared to be to somebody like Francis Scott Key, who was an observer right there. And I'm sure all these years after the fact, it's not easy to understand or to determine with absolute certainty just what occurred. I mean, in the chaos of battle, it can be difficult to know even in the moment what exactly occurred. But what is our best understanding of the peril that was faced by Fort McHenry on that dramatic night?
Sure. Now, the British were very interested in destroying Baltimore. This was the third largest city in the nation at the time, a very important commercial port, and also a center of a lot of the privateering attacks, that's private merchant ships that are armed, that were attacking British commercial vessels. So whereas in Washington, they had burned the federal buildings, but really left private property alone. Baltimore, they were going to teach a different lesson to. Now, 3 weeks after the fall of Washington, you know, the nation is kind of teetering on the brink here. There's fear that if Baltimore falls, Philadelphia and New York won't be far behind. There was, quite a bit of panic in the country, and, you know, the U.S. Treasury was absolutely broke. Banks from New York to South were not accepting U.S. Paper currency anymore. There was a real possibility that if Baltimore falls, the nation is just going to fall apart. So the stakes were very high, and Francis Scott Key was well aware of them when he was watching the bombardment. He, ironically, was a very much an opponent of this war. He had just considered it very foolhardy for the United States to take on one of the world's great powers, and he had been outraged that the United States had attacked Canada, which was then known as British North America, as part of its war strategy. They were trying to take Canadian territory to use as bargaining chips with the British. So he had thought the war was a bad idea to start with and feared it would, you know, bring desolation and destruction to the nation, and he feared that's exactly what he was going to witness when he was watching the attack on Fort McHenry.
Did he almost witness that? I mean, how close were we to defeat in this instance?
We were certainly close on this occasion. The British had a two-pronged attack, and they had landed the army troops at North Point, a peninsula leading to Baltimore, and that was sort of the first phase of the attack. And then the bombardment ships, which had names like Devastation, Terror, Meteor, gives you an idea of the British intent, worked their way up the Patapsco River to position themselves off Fort McHenry to start the bombardment. Some important things had happened in the 3 weeks since Washington was burned. One was that, you know, the shock of that attack had rallied a lot of militia from Pennsylvania, from Maryland, from Virginia, to march to Baltimore, which was believed to be the next point of British attack. So in the intervening weeks, some 15,000 militia had been positioned in a very well-fortified, dug-in hill overlooking the approach that the British would be taking to Baltimore. And a lot of defenses were set up around Fort McHenry, including vessels which were sunk across the mouth of the harbor to protect the city. And you also had some very key naval figures come into the city, John Rogers and Oliver Hazard Perry, David Porter. These were some of the great heroes and names in the U.S. Navy to take over some of the defenses and have their crews man guns to protect the fort. So the city has time, because of British delays, to build up their defenses. And this was to prove very vital when the British launched their attack 200 years ago.
Well, needless to say, Baltimore survived, Fort McHenry survived, the flag survived. And your book goes on, of course, to chronicle a bit more about the writing of these memorable words and the process by which it eventually became our national anthem. Your book also talks about the ongoing efforts to preserve the actual flag that flew over Fort McHenry. All of this amazing story told in the book through the perilous fight from the burning of Washington to the Star-Spangled Banner, 6 weeks that saved a nation, published by Random House. Steve Vogel, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and for writing this important book.
It was my pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation about improvisation in the world of comedy. We're going to be previewing what is a very big event by the Over Our Head Players of Racine. 2 weekends of performances of comedy improv. I'll be speaking with Kristen Althoff, A.J. Laird, and Melissa Tsian, who are three of the participants in these performances that are coming up this coming weekend and the following weekend at the 6th Street Theater in downtown Racine. On Wednesday, from the archives, a conversation about one of the most controversial figures from Hollywood, actress Jane Fonda. We'll be talking with her biographer. On Thursday, Gateway Technical College President Brian Albrecht, with an official from the Department of Education, Dr. Casey Sachs. And on Friday, Dr. Art Sear, his monthly visit to the program. And we're going to spend a good portion of Friday's morning show talking with Dr. Sear about events from 50 years earlier when